invaded Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet, or you put it on the end of a shell, and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because, you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. The Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem, and he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach. Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role. I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine, you can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra Hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desborgues has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, the fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who, like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory 7 times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac municipal cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadići. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadići. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Velja, Puša Ramoni, Turutaš Ljubica, Valušić Moskva.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by, and they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalevic is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadići, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house, blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests reveal that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before, I could take normal showers. But now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh, yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans, Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in 1999.
I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick. A tumor in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumor and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mined.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The job of fighting hatred towards Asian Americans cannot be left to the Asian American Pacific Islander community alone. The majority non-Asian community has a moral obligation to do more to combat this problem. We now present you an article written by Ted Gover, the director of the Tribal Administration Program at Claremont Graduate University. The piece is titled, Americans Need to Do More to Combat Anti-Asian Hate Crimes. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Ted Gover's article. Recently released hate crime figures showing that anti-Asian hate crimes in the United States rose by 149% in 2020, a 50% increase since 2019. It's a call to action to do more to protect people of Asian descent in the United States. These troubling figures point to a reality that not enough is being done by the broader American public to take anti-Asian hate crimes seriously. The job of fighting hatred towards Asian Americans cannot be left to the Asian American Pacific Islander community alone. The majority non-Asian community has a moral obligation to do more to combat this problem. In California, where Asian Americans account for more than 15% of the residents, the Asian American Pacific Islander community has been targeted with increased frequency. According to the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University at San Bernardino, anti-Asian hate crimes have risen by 115% in Los Angeles County, while according to the Asian Pacific Policy and Planning Council, more than 800 COVID-related anti-Asian hate incidents took place statewide from March through to May of 2020. Among the most populous U.S. cities, New York saw the largest annual increase in anti-Asian hate crimes reported to police in 2020. There are different contributing factors to this serious problem, among them American anger at the alleged China's initial mishandling of the COVID-19 outbreak. The rising U.S.-China rivalry, anti-immigrant sentiment, a badly damaged social discourse, a hatred of the other, social media providing a platform for bigots, as well as a failure by too many to push back against anti-Asian American Pacific Islanders statements by various personalities. How to go about combating the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes? The reintroduction of a bipartisan-supported bill in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, the Khaled Jabara and Heather Heyer National Opposition of Hate, Assault and Threats to Equality, or No Hate Act, is a step in the right direction. This proposed legislation would increase assistance to hate crime victims and provide law enforcement authorities with the resources that they need to improve hate crime reporting and tracking. Specifically, the Jabara-Heyer No Hate Act will make U.S. Department of Justice-administered grants available to state and local law enforcement agencies to improve training, hate crime reporting, and the installation of hate crime reporting hotlines. Resources for outreach to affected communities are also part of the bill, in addition to funds to rehabilitate hate crime offenders. The proposed legislation would also allow judges to require hate crime culprits to undergo education and community service that is focused on the particular community affected by the hate crime. A Additionally, U.S. President Joe Biden's executive order banning the use of terms like China virus and Kong flu within the federal agency's operations, documents, and resources was another move. The United States can and must speak out against human rights abuses against Asian Americans, while not allowing the geopolitical challenge of time to lead to the demonization and mistreatment of the Asian American community. A failure to do so harms American fellow citizens whilst contributing to the narrative that America's purported democratic and social model is in irreversible decline, morally bankrupt and unwilling to adhere to its stated ideals. To this end, public-private partnerships should mount a vigorous public education campaign focusing on appropriate anti-hate advocacy initiatives on the airwaves and in the digital sphere. President Joe Biden can also appoint a commission focused on the protection of minorities in American businesses and houses of worship, as well as measures to ensure physical safety on school campuses. Furthermore, stronger efforts to make a dent in the anti-Asian American sentiment must take place in America's classrooms. Tolerance training that teaches of the unique struggle of Asian Americans is needed on a broader basis. Just as schools budget for field trips to Washington, D.C., more educational institutions need to allocate resources for study trips to appropriate historical destinations. In order to augment these programs, educators need to be equipped with all the tools available in teaching today, such as online courses, virtual programs, symposia, learning apps, guest lectures, traveling, exhibits, etc. This obligation to teach our young about both the history and present-day challenges of anti-Asian hate crimes must be facilitated by improved collaboration with the Asian American and non-Asian American educators, police, and other professionals. When possible, present-day victims of anti-Asian hate crimes should be consulted and involved, providing a perspective. Fortifying our schools with improved content about the Asian American Pacific Islander community experience can be a start towards helping our young become grounded, empathetic, and equipped with the knowledge of past injustices. It needs to be made clear to our youth that anti-Asian American Pacific Islander discrimination and hate crimes are not okay. Making headway in this endeavor will involve a long-term, sustained effort by people of all backgrounds. Families, schools, non-profit organizations, faith-based organizations, businesses, law enforcement, and political leaders each need to do their part. Strengthening Asian American Pacific Islander community and non-Asian American Pacific Islander collaborations among neighbors and community leaders will be vital in this ongoing fight.
Ministry.
Six full years of massacres and bombardment campaigns, sanctions and blockade, and Al Saud blatantly want the Yemeni Salvation Government to give up arms and negotiate. However, the Yemeni resistance Ansarullah have refused to put down their weapons and enter any Saudi proposed talks before the full cessation of the Saudi war and the lift of all forms of blockade against the Yemeni nation. The Saudi plan supposedly includes a UN-supervised ceasefire, measures to reopen Sana'a airport in the Yemeni capital, and the lifting of trade restrictions on the Ansarullah-controlled Hudaydah port, but with a twist. The Saudis want to control the airport and the seaport themselves, while also sharing revenues on trade in oil through Hudaydah. Mohammed bin Salman wants to snatch through politics what he was not able to achieve through 6 years of extensive warfare against Yemen. For the Yemeni resistance, the devil is in the details. The Saudi aim is clear. Control of vital Yemeni port of entries after they successfully suffocated the nation, leading it to become the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Whereas the Yemeni resistance wants Hodeidah port and Sana'a airport to be completely open to all international traffic, as they should. The Saudi overture appears to double down on the idea that it is the Yemeni resistance who is being asked to make concessions here, at a time when not only most Saudi-occupied cities have been liberated, but also scores of bomber drones on a weekly basis keep revisiting Saudi oil facilities and military bases in the heart of the kingdom. Ansarullah's response was very clear. This is an old offer, they said. Any new offer should begin with completely lifting barriers to movement on Hodeidah port and Sana'a airport. Using the humanitarian crisis as leverage is simply seen as a deceitful Saudi attempt, and Yemen will not fall for it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. After 6 years of brutal Saudi war on Yemen, the Saudi ceasefire offer was taken by Yemen as nothing short of a joke. What is proposed to the Yemenis is not an end to the war. It is just a ceasefire while all other forms of war continue, such as blocking the airport, seaport, and the borders. What is proposed to Yemenis is a major deceit that neither Ansarullah or the Yemeni children would even accept to fall for. To discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you a lot for being with us, Patrick. Now, Yemeni officials in Sana'a have recently emphasized that Yemen is only open to what they called a fair and honorable peace. That has nothing to do with the deceitful act of the ceasefire offer by Al Saud there, but while maintaining the blockade and maintaining the bombardment campaign against civilian areas in Yemen. Why is the world acting like Yemen has any other option than to actually wait for the war to stop and the blockade to be lifted?
I don't think Saudi Arabia or the world, the Western world for that matter, I don't think they're in a sort of space of reality, because these are all negotiation tactics that we have seen in the past. So, and the West, Saudi Arabia, these powers, they believe that they have leverage on the basis that they have military superiority and they have regional hegemony and they have control of the major waterways, ports, etc., the sky, the air, etc. So this is why they're negotiating as if the Yemeni Ansarullah's capitulation is a fait accompli. But that's not actually how it works when you're in a conflict. And right now, Saudi Arabia is still the aggressor. They can't change that fact. They're in a foreign country, so they don't have the leverage. And so they want to continue to strangle the Yemenis, to strangle Ansarullah in order to somehow get some concessions or some leverage on negotiation. And the Yemenis aren't going to agree to a ceasefire without getting exactly what they want, especially after everything that's happened.
This is why we should maybe look into this initiative. The Saudi initiative is said to include a nationwide ceasefire under the control or the supervision of the UN, supposedly. The reopening of Sana'a airport and Hodeidah port. Knowing that the power in those areas, Hodeidah port, the airport, are in the hands of Ansarullah, could this actually be some sort of a new maneuver for Mohammed bin Salman to try and take control over them, since he already failed to do so militarily?
Possibly, but it could also be a sort of a long-term or medium to long-term strategy, because we've seen this in Syria. We've learned over the last few years that when an international ceasefire is declared, one party will use this as an opportunity to retrench. or to sort of double down or to gain some ground that they had previously lost. Certainly this is something strategically that Saudi Arabia and its backers would like to do. And so for the Yemenis, they're totally in a defensive position, so there's no really change in their strategy. But so the West, and who's backing Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis and their allies are looking for some changes in order to change the strategic landscape. So we've also seen this in Libya. You have half the country, or Tripoli, under a UN administration, as it were. In Yugoslavia, we saw similar tactics with third parties coming in like the UN, and that can create other situations that's going to disrupt or allow one party not to be able to realize the gains that it would like on the battlefield, as it were.
But Patrick, with 5 million people currently teetering on the edge of starvation, and we have over two-thirds of the country's population in need for both food, medicine, and protection. Do you think that Yemen still has more time to waste for such a stalemate offer by Saudi Arabia? And what is the role of the international community in this one?
In terms of the famine, in terms of the human devastation, the humanitarian devastation, there's not a lot that can be done outside of Saudi Arabia withdrawing, its allies withdrawing, and basically leaving Yemen to govern itself, which was the previous status quo. Outside of that, it's going to be difficult. The end game has always been, for Saudi Arabia and its allies, has been partition or regime change, or both. And I really truly believe that they thought this was going to be over within 18 months of when it began in March of 2015, and that hasn't been the case. So if the Yemenis are still where they were before, they're still fighting to preserve their sovereignty, and that's not really going to change despite the devastation.
Well, the Rights and Legal Department at the Yemeni Ansarullah Political Bureau issued its first human rights document that was issued about a week ago about brutal crimes committed by the Saudi-U.S. aggression against Yemeni civilians. We have, it was, by the way, entitled Yemen's Hiroshima. The report included 4,133 documented massacres and bombing incidents in residential areas with details regarding the time and the place of their occurrences. Saudi Arabia has been stacking war crimes in Yemen for the past 6 years. Will Mohammed bin Salman and maybe his generals ever be brought to justice over these horrendous crimes? Do we have a chance against these people?
I think it's doubtful, and this is because international law is at an all-time low, and it's really receding year by year. The only person that's going to get justice from the international law system or end up in The Hague will be some African dictator that was probably installed by a Western power to begin with. Those are the only people you ever see showing up in The Hague, more or less. But the bottom line is that what Saudi Arabia has done is guaranteeing bad blood between the neighbors on the Arabian Peninsula. And so you can't erase that. This is going to sow the seeds for potentially future conflicts. There needs to be a unilateral withdrawal on the side of Saudi Arabia and a cessation of hostilities. This is the only way that we're going to avert more humanitarian disaster. Everything besides that is just really going to be a protracted, painful conflict, unfortunately. Well, we'll see if the West is going to come in like a knight on a white horse to try to, broker some sort of negotiations, or some roadmap to peace. But at the end, I think it's too late for that.
Well, it seems that Biden is a bit in hot water whether to back Mohammed bin Salman or not. Sometimes he gives him a good word, sometimes three bad words in a row. But at the same time, Yemeni civilians are losing their lives. They're losing their lives from bombs falling on their heads, Western-made bombs. They're losing their lives from the famine created by Saudi Arabia with the help of the West. And at the same time, if the West thinks really that they're going to try and do anything doing to stop this without the consent of the Yemeni people, those same Yemenis that are still in control of swaths of land of their country that have been able to liberate the occupied parts of their country, then they are really in on a wrong side here. They don't really understand Yemenis yet. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will be next talking about the Lebanese crisis of economy. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
For the past 19 months, Lebanon has been reeling from a wrenching economic crisis. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was facing four extraordinary challenges: elevated public sector debt, a bankrupt banking sector, no economic growth, and the country was politically rudderless. Predicting how the crisis evolves from here is difficult. Lebanon's economic crisis, a tragedy in the making, in this following report. Lebanon's annual inflation rate reached a record high, and food prices soared by around 500% in February, highlighting the dramatic impact on consumers and businesses of the country's worst financial crisis in decades. With hindsight, Lebanon's economic crisis was predictable. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was already facing four extraordinary challenges. First, public sector debt had reached such elevated levels that a default had become a question of when, not if. Second, the banking sector, having lent three-quarters of deposits to the government, had become functionally bankrupt and increasingly illiquid. Third, the productive economy had experienced virtually no growth for an entire decade, a development with acute socio-political implications. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the country was politically aimless. There was no president between 2014 and 2016. There were multiple and lengthy delays in cabinet formation, and the 2018 parliamentary elections took place, but only after a five-year delay. The Hariri government that was in place when the crisis hit in 2019 became impotent to such an extent that it lacked power to deliver on any of the reforms required as a condition for foreign support. By October 2019, the citizenry had had enough. Sensing a looming crisis and frustrated by the utter lack of action by the political class, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets demanding radical political change. The cabinet resigned, throwing the country into a political crisis. Unsurprisingly, capital inflows came to a sudden halt. Banks, already insolvent, experienced a sharp liquidity crunch, forcing them to declare a bank holiday and institute severe restrictions on bank withdrawals. A foreign exchange black market emerged, and the national currency, the lira, sharply depreciated. In return, inflation soared and people's real wages and purchasing power collapsed. In addition, as if all these woes aren't enough, a severe COVID-19 crisis hit the country, and most tragically, a devastating explosion took place on August 4, 2020, leveling a third of downtown Beirut. Human capital is fast eroding due to a massive brain drain of the young and skilled. Equally worrying is the loss of physical productive capacity resulting from widespread business closures. Much more alarming are the security consequences of the economic implosion. Lebanon's sectarian history is rife with conflict, and economic collapse provides a perfect habitat for a return of violence. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Nasri Harb, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Yuzal University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nasri Harb. Now, left to its own devices, the Lebanese economy will for sure generate an alarming acceleration of youth and skilled labor immigration. We have a lot of enterprises closing. The currency is becoming further unanchored. Hyperinflation is wiping the incomes of the public and their wealth, and we have now food and medical shortages that seem will only escalate, which requires more level of humanitarian support, foreign humanitarian support. That is the worst case scenario, and I thought that we were already there. Could this become even worse now?
Okay, hi Marwa. I think there is no limit to how bad we can go. Let me tell you this, as long as the government does not take any action, things will worsen. The hyperinflation will fuel itself. As a number, we can cite two recent examples from two economies. In Venezuela, for instance, where inflation has reached about 65,000%.
Wow.
That is a 71% inflation every month, which means that your salary that you receive at the beginning of the month will lose 70% of its value at the end of the month. So you are left with only 30%. Another typical example is, a famous example is Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, in the peak of the hyperinflation, currency used to lose a 98%, which is almost its whole value every day at the peak of the inflation. So there is no limit to how bad we can go.
That is a scary thought right there.
Indeed.
But there is one best case scenario for Lebanon that's being discussed all around now, is by starting with a cabinet. That should be giving some sort of a short-term stabilization program for the country, which involves tightening of liquidity, maybe arresting the fiscal implosion, maybe inducing capital control, especially on large amounts of money which are still being leaked out of the country, and maybe obtaining an urgent external bridge loan like that of the IMF. However, look, I understand all these points that we are speaking about, but wouldn't even more loans by the Lebanese be a burden for them rather than an actual escape from this reality?
The loan from the IMF, you can say it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, from one side, it will call for more reform, it will help, and it will ask for discipline from the government. However, on the other hand, if there is no discipline, if the loan is not well negotiated, because the trend at the IMF is to follow more liberal action, reducing government size, and taking harsh action towards the harsh social action. So if it's not well negotiated, it may lead to further social problems.
You mean more privatization instead of actually putting help towards the public institutions?
Exactly. So it takes strong political action and strong political negotiation to negotiate a good terms for these loans. That's one. Two, if this loan is not well used, it will add to the burden of the country, like the debt to the country, like similar to what happened to Paris conferences. We have received aids and billions of dollars, and after all, it came out like as a burden on the country.
And our debt becomes $120 billion.
Exactly.
But the annual inflation rate, Dr. Harbi, is that it reached a high record, and the food prices soared. There are more than 500% this February 2021, highlighting the dramatic impact on both consumers and enterprises as well, especially because this is the worst economic crisis for at least 2 decades. How much longer do you think these businesses can withstand such a dramatic impact on them?
It's difficult to say, but however, the conditions are very harsh. If we can cite what are the problems faced by the businesses, it's unbelievable. You have one, reduced demand. People are poorer than before. Difficult investment because there is no exchange. Unstable exchange rate. You can start with a given price, and then at the end of the day, the price will be changed. Uncertainty. Okay, you can never tell what to expect in the next day. Unmotivated employees, which will reduce the cost of production.
Mm-hmm.
You have also angry consumer, which will be very difficult to deal with. You have difficult financial transaction. If you want to export, if you want to import, how can I afford the exchange rate? Okay, the cost of changing price is by itself. The cost of changing price is huge. Mm-hmm. In some cases, in some supermarket, like during I think German hyperinflation, 50% of the employees' time was on only changing prices.
So it's very costly for the
exactly.
enterprise.
So just changing prices takes like 50% of your resources. So
and the remaining 50% is now becoming a referee trying to stop people from killing one another.
That's
but
true.
What are you saying represents a public call, Dr. Nasri, to all Lebanese decision makers, whether it is the prime minister designated one, the central bank governor, even the president of the republic as well. I personally do not see a glimmer of hope here. I'm a realist. But as an economist, what would be the first thing that you would do to try and salvage what is left of the economy in this country?
Okay. Well, we were speaking about that in a conference a few days ago. Mm-hmm. What it takes at the beginning, first of all, like a political will. Okay. Once we have a political will, any action can help. It takes a multilateral plan. You have, first of all, of course, you have to have a sort of capital control. You have to and that's very important, to establish trust. So I would say trust, then trust, then trust. That's the first point. Capital control, restoration of banking sector, okay? And we can speak also about halting the money printing process, because this is the main cause of the inflation. Economical reforms and structural reforms. I can speak here about political reform and economical reform. Especially, like we can give an example, a simple example, which will be a good start, is to rebuild the electrical system for electrical sector. Rebuild it, okay. And an important one is to encourage import substituting industries, mm-hmm. because this is one of the main source of fleeing the currency.
See, this is what we lack in Lebanon, Dr. Nasri. We mm-hmm. should have someone like you to be Minister of Economy, and yet we are still fighting between one another which sect will get which ministry, which, by the way, puts me at a very depressed position as a Lebanese citizen, because I don't know whether tomorrow will be better or even 10 times worse. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri, Harab economist and Dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Izal University. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Corporations can and should bankroll much of what America needs, but they won't as long as corporations keep bankrolling American politicians. The basic deal between American corporations and American politicians has been a terrible deal for America. We're prepared for you an article written by Robert Reich, the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also a senior fellow at the Bloom Center for Developing Economics. The piece is titled, "The Terrible Deal Between Corporate America and the GOP is Alive and Well." Please stay with us for more of Robert Reich's article.